Move to the final case of the day, which is the United States versus Tanya Lee. Mr. Cupsis?
May it please the court, Vosvaldas Cupsis arguing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Tanya Lee. This case arises from a superseding indictment which was filed on April 20th of 2006. In relevant part, Tanya Lee was charged under counts 1, 2, and 3 of that indictment. Count 1 was conspiracy to commit bank robbery under Section 371, alleging violations of 2113A and 2113D of 18 United States Code, carried a 5-year maximum penalty. Count 2 was an attempted bank robbery charge, which essentially alleged that under 2113A, Tanya Lee had taken money from a bank by either force, violence, or intimidation, and under 2113D, during the course of that action, she had put in jeopardy the life of another by the use of a dangerous weapon. Count 3 alleged actual bank robbery. Count 2 was an attempt, in which Tanya Lee was again charged under 2113A and 2113D. Specifically, the factual allegations that came out at trial related, one, to count two, the attempted bank robbery, were that on October 1st of 2005, Tanya, Nicole, and Sharon Williams plotted a bank robbery at the People's Bank in Munster, Indiana. Tanya Lee actually entered the bank wearing a scream mask in an attempt to disguise herself. There, she managed to enter into the front foyer of the bank through the front entrance. There was a scuffle between herself and one of the other bank employees, and at that point in time, she fled the scene. Her co-defendant, Sharon Williams, the evidence alleged, had brought with her a toy gun to the scene of the bank robbery. However, Sharon Williams never exited the vehicle in question. The toy gun remained with Sharon Williams at all times pertinent. No money was taken. The bank robbery was unsuccessful, and thus it was charged as an attempt. Count 3 regarded facts that occurred on October 18th of 2005. At that point in time, Tanya Lee and another co-defendant, Alethea Jones, entered the Citizens Bank in the Northern District of Indiana. At this time, it's alleged that Alethea Jones, in fact, had the toy gun in her possession and that sometime during the course of the robbery, she flashed the toy gun to representatives of the bank. In this particular case, the bank robbery was, in fact, successful, and Alethea Jones and Tanya Lee left the bank with approximately $80,000 cash. When the matter went to trial, at the close of the government's case, defendant's counsel moved for a judgment of acquittal on count two, specifically arguing that there were no facts to support the government's contention that, in fact, a dangerous weapon had been utilized in this case under 2113D. During the course of that judgment of acquittal, there were conversations between the government attorney and also the judge in which the government attorney essentially indicated that it was his belief that the inclusion of 2113D was never intended by the government, and this was more along the way of a scrivener's error, and essentially moved to strike or effectively amend that count by removing 2113D. The court did not grant a motion to amend by the government, but rather ruled on defendant's motion, in fact granting the judgment of acquittal as to 2113D, however allowing 2113A to stand. Essentially, the court, after hearing the contentions of the parties, indicated that they were going to grant a partial judgment of acquittal related to 2113D. The defendant's argument is that effectively what happened in this case was under count two, defendant was charged with attempted bank robbery, and one of the elements of that charge was that she in fact utilized a deadly weapon to put other participants in fear of their life or in danger. What the court effectively did when they granted the partial judgment of acquittal related to 2113D is they modified the charge. They removed an element of the charge as it was set forth in the indictment. The indictment clearly indicates that they are accusing Tanya Lee of attempted bank robbery under 2113A, which is essentially using fear, intimidation, violence to remove money from a bank, and possessing a dangerous weapon, putting another person in fear of their life. The court modified what Tanya Lee was actually charged with. What they effectively did was remove that element and, in fact, prejudiced Tanya Lee. And prejudice in this case is one of our main arguments, Your Honor. We feel that, one, the court, rather than strike that, what should have been done here, if in fact there was a Scrivener's error, there should have been another indictment filed. If the government, in fact, made a mistake, there should have been a superseding indictment. There should have been a new charge that went before a grand jury. This should not have taken place after the conclusion of the government's case. Tanya Lee was prejudiced, one, that obviously her theory of defense was pretty much taken away from her at this point in time by the court's allowance of the amendment. Second of all, under the federal system, discovery is somewhat limited. And what we have here is Tanya Lee was facing charges carrying a higher penalty, aggravated bank robbery. This affected her situation as far as entering a plea of guilty. At the time of the change of plea hearing, the court, in fact, advised her that under the indictment, one of the elements that she had to admit to was possession of a deadly weapon, 21D, or 2113D. It's a material change. It should have been done by indictment. It was inappropriate to allow a constructive amendment. And, in fact, further under our system was she prejudiced based on the changes in penalties affecting her ability to make a decision as far as plea, which could have been done had the case been properly indicted, and, in fact, affects her sentencing levels, penalty levels based on acceptance, and, therefore, based on a change in the charges. For all these reasons, the changes here we submit were, in fact, material. If this was to be done, it should have been done by indictment. If, in fact, the court concurs, in which they did, that the evidence was insufficient to establish that there was a dangerous weapon involved under count two, the court should have dismissed count two in its entirety, Your Honor. That's essentially our argument in a nutshell, that they should not have been allowed to basically take out a piece of that, effectively amending the indictment, prejudicing the defendant and violating her Fifth Amendment rights, Your Honor. And for those reasons, we ask that the court, in fact, reverse count two and find that, in fact, a dismissal should have been granted based on defendant's attorney's motion for judgment on acquittal on that charge.
Why isn't this appropriately viewed as the submission of a lesser-included offense to the jury? What's wrong with that?
Well, because that's not the way the instructions came down in this case. What basically happened here is the government said, look, we made a Scrivener's error, we shouldn't have charged this. The court effectively took that out. And what I'm saying is that that is, in fact, a material element. If the government, in fact, intended to charge her and indict her in the way that they did, then they should have proceeded to trial in that fashion. It was inappropriately done. The court effectively amended the indictment rather than instructing the jury on a lesser-included offense.
Well, the jury was instructed on the offense that was submitted to it, right, which is the attempt bank robbery, not the attempt armed bank robbery? And that's the verdict form the jury was given?
That's correct. They
so
were
the jury
instructed.
Wasn't given an instruction on the greater offense.
But the offense charged, as it was charged in the indictment, in fact included that dangerous weapon portion.
Well, I understand that, but the court found that that was a mistake and submitted the lesser included, as it's permitted to do under Rule 31. And I'm not following what's wrong with that procedure.
Well, what the argument is here, had this simply been argued from an evidentiary standpoint, the court found we find that the evidence here was insufficient to support that particular charge. But that's not what happened here. What happened here is the government said, oh, look, we made a mistake in our indictment. We have a Scrivener's error here. The defendant was operating under that premise throughout the course of these proceedings. The court effectively allowed the government to amend its indictment, which it admittedly had set forth in error through its action of judgment of acquittal, partial judgment of acquittal. It wasn't done based on the evidence. It essentially was done to correct the amendment that the government came forth with. The indictment was presented improperly. However, the defendant relied upon that indictment in this case, and removing that material element without doing it by new indictment, in fact, prejudiced her in her defense for those reasons, Your Honor.
You're always allowed to shave unnecessary things from an indictment.
Not if it...
I don't know where the possible prejudice could be here.
Well, the possible prejudice occurs, the indictment was filed. I mean, one, the entire case has been tried by the government. Cross-examination has been rendered. The defendant's entire focus is on the elements of the case as charged. Allowing the government to effectively amend the charges after the conclusion of their case prejudices the defendant in the entire theory of their presentation of cross-examination in regard to the government's witnesses, completely changes their focus in that extent. Furthermore, a plea agreement in this case fell through, and partially the court relied upon the government's presentation of that deadly weapon in the plea negotiations. I'm not saying that was the sole reason that the plea fell apart.
Were you trial counsel in this case?
I was not trial counsel, Your Honor.
You know, I think the peculiar thing is that she was acquitted on count three,
which
seems to be
quite frankly,
serious.
Had the strongest evidence, Your Honor. And that's why the dangerous weapon portion of these charges was a key element in those two counts.
You mean because it was a fake, they may not have thought it was a dangerous weapon?
I believe that the jury perceived, and government's attorney may disagree, perceived that it was in fact a toy gun and in fact was not capable of causing any type of harm to the bank employees.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nozick?
May it please the Court, David Nozick on behalf of the government. I'm an AUSA in the Northern District of Indiana. I'll keep this very brief in that I think this honorable court has touched upon the government's main points. Government's position is there are basically two levels of analysis here. The first level is this simply a Scrivener's error which the court could permissibly correct, or the government could permissibly correct during trial or at the end of evidence. Mr. Koopsis eloquently argued for his side. However, the government takes issue with his position that the defense was proceeding all along under the assumption that this was an aggravated bank robbery. This court has in its possession the indictment. The text of the indictment says that it was a simple unarmed bank robbery in that charge. Yes, it's correct that the citation 2113 A and D are both in there. The government's position is that the text should dictate. Moving along, jury instructions were submitted in advance of trial in this case, as in every case in our district, and the jury instruction for that charge laid out the elements and did not have the armed element. Furthermore, after that, or during roughly the same period of time, the week of trial or so, a statement of the case is prepared. And the way this happens is the government prepared it. I showed it to Clark Holsinger, who was the trial lawyer in this case. He made some minor amendments, and then that's submitted to the court as a joint statement of the case. And that joint statement of the case clearly stated that count two was a simple unarmed bank robbery. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, the charge is read to the jury at the beginning of trial, and that charge is read as a simple unarmed bank robbery. At no point in time, judges, when the jury instructions were submitted, when the statement of case was prepared, and when the charge was read to the jury, did Clark Holsinger or the defendant say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? Count two, I thought that was an aggravated armed bank robbery. That was never brought up at any point in time. Defense has eloquently pointed out that, at least in part, the plea agreement broke down. Strike that. There's no plea agreement. She was attempting to plea in the blind. And he argues that that broke down in part because of the issue of the weapon. I would submit, and it's in the record, that it broke down not on that issue. The judge did, Judge Lozano did, when he's going through the elements quickly, say that that was an element. However, we didn't even get to that element, judges. They said the defendant refused to admit that any force was used whatsoever. She went into the facts where she went into the foyer. She grabbed an employee of the bank for the bank to open. She used force. She dragged her. She threatened to kill her. She told the woman inside, let me in or I'll kill her. She wouldn't admit to any of that. She said that the bank employee reached for my mask and I brushed her hand away, and that was where it broke down. The government would also submit that even if it did, if you took defense's argument and accepted it, even if it did break down on that issue, well, the prejudice and the solution there isn't that the motion for judgment of acquittal should have been granted fully. The solution would have been, or the proper argument, I believe, by the defense, or the best argument, should have been at sentencing that she should have gotten acceptance of responsibility, but she, you know, because she tried to plead guilty and that fell apart because of confusion over the gun issue. And that issue is not before the court today. So the government's first argument, as I've stated, is this is a Scrivener's error, and that's clear because of the text of the indictment, jury instructions, statement of the case, charge read to the jury. If this honorable court should reject that argument, the second level of analysis is could the honorable Judge Lozano grant in part a motion for judgment of acquittal and deny it in part and submit a lesser included offense to the jury? And this honorable court has asked that of Mr. Koopsis today. And the answer, of course, is yes. I was unable to locate a single decision standing for the proposition that a court cannot grant in part a motion for a judgment of acquittal and submit a lesser included offense to the jury. For some reason, there was a scarcity of cases on point, perhaps because it's sort of such a obvious fact. There was a Second Circuit case right on point submitted. That's the LaRusso case, LORUSSO, 695 F. Second 45. There are a number of Seventh Circuit cases where it's not argued directly on point, but where it comes up in the facts of the case that the motion for judgment of acquittal was partially granted and a lesser was submitted to the jury. Defense at trial was unable to cite to any court cases whatsoever saying that was impermissible, and in the appellate brief, there's not a single case cited for the proposition that you cannot submit a lesser included offense to the jury. I think we're all agreeing that a simple bank robbery is a lesser included offense of an aggravated bank robbery. Finally, or second to last, defense counsel keeps referring to this as a constructive amendment, an improper constructive amendment of the indictment. All of the cases he cites are cases in which the amendment is indicted in a way that changes the offense by adding elements and broadening the elements. Virtually every case cited by the defense uses the word broadening, saying it's impermissible surprise to broaden the elements and to broaden the charges at trial. The defense hasn't had the chance to prepare for that. Keep in mind, as I've said a number of times, we are shrinking, we're lessening the elements at trial. And finally, on the prejudice issue, defense keeps saying, well, it ruined, you know, it went to our theory of the case, and we were prejudiced, we would have prepared differently. But apparently what defense counsel is arguing is their theory of the case and the way they were going to defend it was to argue for the lesser included offense and argue against the weapon. And that's exactly what went to the jury, and that's exactly what the defendant was convicted of. At this point in time, that concludes my comments. Does this honorable court have any questions for me?
Yes, not.
Thank you.
I believe your time had expired. I'd give you half a minute if you really got something you got to add. Okay. I understand you were court appointed. Is that correct?
I'm filling in for Mr. Holsinger. I'm also a CJA attorney, but I think it's technically still his case.
All right. Well, thanks anyway. Okay. The case will be taken under advisement. That completes our argument for the day, where it will be in recess until tomorrow morning.